Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the September 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. And one of those Wednesdays will be coming up a week from today when it'll be time to hear your takes on the world. Last Wednesday, September 15th, marked the 200th anniversary of Mexico's independence from Spain. It should have been a day of celebration, but there is little for Mexicans to celebrate these days, either on the border or far south of it. The threat of violence generating from heavily armed drug syndicates seems to be everywhere, and many of those who attempt to do something to counter or expose it, be they politicians or journalists, sooner or later end up dead. Today, about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with Professor Miguel Tinker Salas about the situation in Mexico and what happens to be a breakdown, what appears to be a breakdown in civil society, as well as getting his comments on Venezuela's parliamentary elections that are coming up this Sunday. Before I get him on the phone, let's take a look at some things that have happened since our last visit 2 weeks ago. Last time, I spent a considerable amount of time talking about the military deals between Washington and Israel that haven't yet made the mainstream press, and it left a number of questions unanswered, questions that I have posed to the so-called Defense Department, which have yet to be answered, although I have received additional information on one of them, the prospective quote-unquote sale to Israel of 20 F-35 jet fighters when they are expected to become available in 2015. What was unusual and troubling, I pointed out, was that Israel, which plans to pay for the planes with the $2.75 billion we give them annually for such purchases, would not only be getting them for nothing, but would get an additional $4 to $5 billion in jobs assembling wing elements for one quarter of the planned 3,200 F-35 fighters, work that could otherwise be done by American aerospace workers. It turns out the story is a bit more complicated than that, as I found out from an article in Canadian press, the Ottawa Citizen, to be more precise. It seems that news of the Israelis being handed up to $5 billion in aircraft assembly jobs has not gone down well with the Canadians, who had invested over $9 billion in developing the F-35 and had expected that Canadian workers would be in line for some of those jobs, whereas Israel had not invested so much as a single penny or shekel. Canadian Liberal Party defense critic Dominic LeBlanc pointed his finger at the Harper government, noting that, quote, after racking up a record $54 billion deficit and blowing more than $1 billion on a 72-hour 6G8 G20 meeting, the conservative new priorities are $10 billion for prisons and $16 billion for planes, all at a time when Canadian families are struggling to make ends meet. This is a government whose priorities are seriously out of touch with the needs of Canadians, end quote. One can certainly say the same about ours as well. On the basis of the cozy arrangement with the U.S., the Israeli government recently announced that, quote, the Ministerial Committee on Security Affairs, chaired by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak, has decided to approve the deal to purchase F-35 stealth aircraft. Ministers commended the staff work and contacts with the U.S. Defense Department, Joint Strike Fighter Program, and the plane's manufacturers, the statement continued. The staff work covered not only the plane's capabilities and cost, but also, mind you, the integration of Israel's security industries in the manufacturing of the plane and integration of Israeli systems in the plane, end quote. The official statement concluded with a statement from Netanyahu, who said that, quote, acquiring the most innovative combat plane in the world is a significant step in strengthening the state of Israel's military capabilities, end quote. The Canadians may not be the only ones put out by the U.S.-Israel deal. According to the editor of the website DefenseAerospace.com, quote, if the above statement about the integration of Israeli industry and systems is true, then Israel has been allowed a level of access to the F-35 far beyond that obtained by the United Kingdom and Italy, which, unlike Israel, are full risk-sharing partners in the program, end quote. I guess that's why they call it a special relationship. The biggest news when it comes to arms sales, and this is like a drug trade, is the intent of the Obama administration to sell $60 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, which will make it the biggest arms sale in history. What a touch of irony for the Nobel Prize winner. Peace Prize winner, I should say. Even the Guardian of London writes Al Jazeera's Taymour Nabili is dutiful in parroting without question the accepted Western narrative for the sale. The Guardian said, the sale under negotiations in 2007 is aimed mainly at bolstering Saudi defenses against Iran, which the U.S. suspects will achieve nuclear weapon capability within the next few years. The transfer of advanced technology, mainly planes, is to provide Saudi Arabia with air superiority over Iran, end quote. That's the official story. Ignoring the fact that military aircraft, which form the bulk of the deal as we know it, are pretty much useless against a nuclear missile, especially one that does not exist, writes Nabili, $60 billion buys a mind-boggling amount of firepower. So that must mean that Saudi Arabia's military capacity right now is woefully insufficient compared to Iran's, right? No, notes Nabili. Saudi military spending already dwarfs Iran's by a factor of 6. Indeed, by head of population, Saudi is the world's biggest purchaser of military hardware. If the mainstream media missed the point, then what is really going on, he asks. Well, with America suffering its worst recession in 60 years, the biggest arms contract ever signed would certainly be a welcome boost to earnings in the military-industrial sector. And as I blogged a year ago, writes Al Jazeera's Nabili, Saudi Arabia has always been keen to buy as much favor in Washington as it can, because it's concerned that any hint of warming relations between D.C. and Tehran would almost by definition be a threat to Riyadh's regional hegemony. Meanwhile, he notes, The Guardian highlights one other richly ironic aspect of this deal. Quote, while Israel sees Saudi Arabia as a useful buttress against Iran, there is fear in Tel Aviv that a rogue Saudi pilot might opt for a suicide mission against Israel. The Israeli Air Force wants to maintain an advantage, so Washington will probably be announcing another big arms sale soon, this time to Israel, end quote. But maybe it's something else. Saudi Arabia is about to make the most expensive arms deal in history at $60 billion for the 84 new F-fighters, F-15 fighters, and upgrades for 70 older models, plus nearly 200 Apache, Black Hawk, and Longbird helicopters, and there's nary a peep from Israel or its Washington lobby. That's according to Douglas Bloomfield, formerly a senior APAC staff member in his blog on the Jerusalem Post. In fact, Bloomfield adds, they've privately blessed the sale, according to congressional, Israeli, and lobby sources. One big reason, he notes, is that Israeli defense firms stand to make tens of millions on the Saudi sale by manufacturing key components, including the vertical stabilizers, portions of the wings, and the conformal fuel pods for the Saudi F-15s, end quote. According to Bloomfield, Israeli officials have been praising the Obama administration for consulting closely on the Saudi package and providing assurances the Saudis will not get the same level of avionics and armaments on the F-15, particularly precision-guided long-range standoff weapons, end quote. Israel, continues Bloomfield, no longer sees Saudi Arabia as a threat, despite the official state of war, but as an ally against their mutual enemy, Iran. Security services of both countries have been exchanging intelligence reports on what's going on in Iran. End quote. Well, that's a bit deceptive. Israel has never seen the Saudis as a threat. They are well aware, and have been for some time, that the Saudis have never had enough pilots or trained men under arms to fly or operate the weapons they buy from the U.S. Its purchase of weapons, not just at the present time, but from the beginning of the relationship, has been intended to keep the U.S. arms industry functioning and profitable. In exchange, the Saudis know that the U.S. will always be there to defend them, as long as they keep the oil flowing. A number of you have asked in the past what they can do from here to affect a change in U.S. support for Israel. In case you haven't heard, there is a proposed ballot initiative in California that would force the state's two public employee pension funds to withdraw investments from companies that, quote, support Israeli settlement or supply military products to the government of Israel, end quote. The Israel Divestment Campaign, a recently formed organization, announced the initiative at a demonstration last Wednesday, in front of the Israeli consulate in Los Angeles. Its author, Chris Yatuma, is head of fiscal policy for the California Community College Chancellor's Office in Sacramento. Yatuma, an Arab American in his mid-40s, is also the founder of the Israel Divestment Campaign. To qualify as an initiative for next year's ballot, supporters must collect the signatures of 434,000 registered California voters, a complex and expensive undertaking, by January 31st. California's separate pension funds for public employees and for teachers are estimated to have a total investment portfolio of approximately $300 billion. Some of the American companies that would be affected by the initiative should it pass are Caterpillar, Motorola, Northrop Grumman, General Electric, and ITT. Switching wheels to the standoff with Iran, a special investigative report by Reuters alleges that Turkey and other U.S. allies have been allowing Iranian banks with suspected links to Tehran's nuclear program to do business within their borders, frustrating Western countries trying to put a financial squeeze on the Islamic Republic. An examination of classified reports and interviews with Western diplomats, government and intelligence officials underscore that Turkey and others have resisted international pressure to make it harder for Iran to finance its uranium enrichment program. Turkey's blossoming financial-economic relationship with Iran provides Iran with a gateway to the entire European financial system, according to an intelligence report on Turkey and Iran provided to Reuters by an unnamed diplomat. Turkey, a NATO member, has enjoyed growing economic and financial relations with neighboring Iran. Trade between the two nations reached $10 billion in 2008 and could triple in 5 years. Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan told the group of businessmen he met together with Iran's first vice president Mohammad Reza Rahimi last week. Much of that trade is legitimate, notes Reuters, but if Turkey becomes a virtual safe haven for Iranian banking activities, it will be easier for Tehran to dodge sanctions, according to diplomats. That's from Reuters. I have a hunch the unnamed diplomats cited here are either American or Israeli. Turkish President Abdullah Gül clarified Monday that he would not be meeting with Israeli President Shimon Peres in New York at the UN General Assembly meeting due to a tight schedule. He added, however, that, quote, "We will not forgive Israel for those killed in the Israeli attack on the aid flotilla, even if Israel apologizes," end quote. His remarks were quoted by Turkey's official Anatolia news agency. According to Israeli sources, the meeting was thwarted due to Peres' refusal to apologize for the deadly Navy raid, and the sources said the Turks demanded the apology as a condition for holding a meeting. What is interesting, but not surprising, is that what news stories I have recently seen about Israel's attack on the Mavi Marmara in April no longer refer to the 9 men killed by the Israelis as 8 Turks and 1 Turkish American. They now write of Fulkan Dogan, who was born in Troy, New York, and who died as a U.S. citizen, as simply the 9th Turk. Dogan was shot 5 times in less than 45 centimeters in the face, in the back of the head, twice in the leg, and once in the back. And there was a YouTube on the internet in which you can see that shooting, that murder. As for the so-called Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, the farce continues. In Israel, the report of the meeting between Netanyahu, Abbas, and Hillary Clinton did not even make the front pages of any of Israel's major newspapers. We may know a little bit more next week after Netanyahu refuses to extend the almost non-existent settlement freeze, and you may wish to comment about it when we have open line. My guest today, Miguel Tinker Salas, is a professor of Latin American history and of Chicano studies at Pomona College. He is the author of Under the Shadow of the Eagles, The Border and the Transformation of Sonora During the Porfiriato, 1997, most recently The Enduring Legacy, Oil Culture and Society in Venezuela, published by Duke University. Welcome once again, Miguel Tinker Salas, to Takes on the World.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you doing?
Very good. Glad to have you with us again. You know, the first time we spoke was in the spring of 2009, and President Obama was about to attend a meeting in the Organization of American States. When he ran for the White House, he promised a positive change in the relationship between the U.S. and its neighbors to the south, which a string of U.S. officials over the years have viewed as America's backyard. Then we spoke again last September, and you gave us a less than upbeat progress report on the president's commitments to Latin America. And then last Wednesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated that Mexico and Central America were facing an insurgency in the form of well-organized network drug trafficking syndicates that required the equivalent of a Plan Colombia in the region. As could be expected, her comments immediately aroused the ire of the Mexican government and the specter of expanded U.S. military intervention. But there seems to be no question that these drug trafficking gangs have adopted the tactics and weapons of insurgencies they would see in other parts of the world and in Mexico. And on the country's 200th anniversary of its independence, it seems to be being torn apart. It's obviously not the whole story. How do you see it?
Well, I think the country does face a major crisis, and it, one of the things that highlighted it was a recent article on Sunday from El Diario, the daily paper from Ciudad Juarez, which actually front page ran an article concerning the narco-traffickers saying, what is it you want? We recognize you now as the de facto authority in Ciudad Juarez. We recognize you as having the superior power than the military or the government. Could you please tell us what you want, and please stop killing journalists? When you get to that kind of situation, you've already had a condition in which, in fact, the state has eroded. The state is now confronting a major challenge from the narco-traffickers, not so much from the point of view of an insurgency, because the narco-traffickers do not seek to replace the Mexican state. In fact, the Mexican state, in some cases, is their best ally. What they seek to do is to gain spaces in which they can operate, and they've done that in cooperation with, in some cases, municipal, other cases, state government, in other cases, federal government. So this is a major crisis. I think that the strategy that the Mexican government has adopted is simply wrong. It has produced thousands of deaths, and besides the capture of a few narco kingpins, it's done much of nothing else. In fact, the price of drugs continues to increase. The narcos traffickers are making upwards of $40 billion a year, it's speculated, and drugs are readily available in the United States. So as long as you have an illicit, unregulated market in the U.S. attracting $40 billion or more, you will continue to have narco trafficking in Mexico as well.
Well, of course, the weapons that are being used by the narco traffickers come from this side of the border. And we have this, what they call the Second Amendment, or there's a Second Amendment, which has been translated or interpreted as meaning anybody could have any kind of weapon they want. And obviously, it's these weapons that are being sold throughout the Southwest that are ending up in Mexico, no?
Yeah, the weapons do come in great number from the United States, but it's the traffickers' ability to bring in drugs illicitly into Mexico from Colombia. They can bring weapons in from any part of the world. In fact, the question of the U.S. Access to weaponry is utilized by the Mexican government to sort of talk about joint responsibility or co-responsibility, when in reality the drug traffickers can bring in drugs from any parts of the world, the same way that they're bringing in drugs from Colombia, from South America, elsewhere, to traffic them. And sometimes they get weapons from the Mexican military, some soldiers who are so underpaid that they sell their own weapons. But yes, the narco traffickers are highly armed with sophisticated weaponry, and in some cases weaponry that's better than what the Mexican military has.
Well, it seems in some respects that even though the narco traffickers have a different agenda, that the war in Mexico is becoming more and more to resemble what we saw in Iraq or in Afghanistan, with the government troops killing civilians. Just the other day, in Nuevo León, but they have actually, in some areas, are more feared than the narco traffickers. No.
The military has had over 4,000 human rights violations filed against them. The military is not in a position to actually serve as a police force. But the reality is that the Mexican municipal polices, in many cases, have been completely penetrated by the narco traffickers. Are in the payment of the narco traffickers, on the payroll of the narco traffickers, and therefore the government has relied on the military. That's led to the militarization of entire regions of Mexico. It's impossible to travel through Chihuahua, Coahuila, Nuevo León without seeing how militarized the region is. So there is no safe space in Mexico. The war with the narco traffickers has been taken to Mexico City, it's been taken to Cuernavaca and Morelos, it's been taken to Chihuahua, it's been taken to Oaxaca. It is occurring throughout the entire country with a kind kind of violence that is never been seen before in Mexican society or Mexican history, with the beheadings, the mutilations, the destruction of human beings in ways that have not been part of the reality in Mexican society in the past.
Now, it seems that honest public officials and a number of journalists, those who take on or try to expose what's going on with the narco traffickers, end up dead or disappeared.
There is, in fact, already several journalists from Ciudad Juarez who have requested asylum in the United States. The profession of journalist is one that's been targeted by the narco traffickers, and the reality is that the Mexican state cannot and will not protect the journalists. In some cases, they have used them as bait to attract the narco traffickers, so journalists are left onto their own designs. This is why the daily in Ciudad Juarez, El Diario, published their account in which they were asking the narco traffickers, what is it you want? What is it we have to do for you to stop killing the journalist? And that caused a reaction in Mexico City, because again, the Mexico City can quite smugly say, oh no, we control the country. But the reality on the ground in a place like Ciudad Juarez has had over 2,300 assassinations this year alone, and is the most violent city in the world, more than Baghdad or Fallujah or any place in Persia, is in fact under the control of the narco traffickers, despite the government pumping in money. Despite the fact that the government has had soldiers on the ground, it has not won this battle. And the same way that the U.S. recognizes that it cannot win the battle in Iraq and Afghanistan solely on military terms, the Mexican government refuses to acknowledge that this issue is a social issue, this issue is a judicial issue, this issue is a political issue. And until they develop a more comprehensive strategy, they will not really gain an upper hand in the conflict with the narco traffickers.
But I'm curious about the elements that have caused the upsurge in narco trafficking, because narco trafficking between Mexico and the United States, or Central America through Mexico and the United States, has been going on for a number of years. And I haven't been to Mexico in quite a long time, but I'm wondering how much has, let's say, NAFTA contributed to this. How much has the Walmartization of Mexico? There's a story in last month that Mexico is going to Walmex, which is a Walmart of Mexico, is about to open 360 new store city in 360 cities in Mexico and Central America. And what they're looking for is to take more business away from what they call the informal markets. These are the mom and pop markets that one finds in Mexico, in every city, in every village, in the cities and towns, which have been largely wiped out, I suspect, by the Walmartization. How much has this economic war against the people, in a sense, contributed to the narco trafficking uprise?
I think it plays an important role, and it plays an important role on various fronts. On the first one is that the Mexican state, when it began to project itself or began to negotiate the free trade agreement, actually beginning as early as the 1980s, the middle of the 1980s, began to really pull back from its national project, began to pull back from its nationalist project, began to open up the economy, began to open up the political arena, and withdrew in many ways from the very nationalist project that it had been so identified with since the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1920, so that in many ways it opened up spaces. As those spaces were opened up, as the state retreated from social services, from cultural programs, etc., the narco traffickers began to fill those voids. They began to become a state within a state. So, for example, in La Familia in Michoacán, which is a major narco trafficking force to this day, will offer health benefits, will offer pension plans, will offer protection plans for the population. So, in essence, they have begun to replace the Mexican state in very concrete and real ways within the Mexican population. Second, as you open up new avenues for commerce and for trade, that also is an attraction and a magnet for illegal trade, because the thousands of containers now going north are also a vehicle for which drug trafficking can actually pass through into the territory. So that it's with the promotion of new rail lines, new transportation lines, with the promotion of new ports, the narco traffickers have had greater opportunity to actually get products into the U.S. on a much streamlined fashion. But also, U.S. policy has done this also. U.S. policy in South America and the eradication of coca leaf production in Bolivia or in places like Peru, where it was a natural product grown by indigenous peoples, and pushing that into Colombia, then forced the Colombian narco traffickers to make relationships with the Mexican narco traffickers. And now it has become a vertically integrated operation, very much along the lines of neo neoliberal market strategies. That is, with producers and with refiners and distributors all now operating in tandem and working in a network that takes products from Colombia through Central America, who wreaks violence on Central America and Mexico to get products to the U.S. But let's not forget that the principal reason we have this is because there's a market for it in the U.S. There's a $40 billion market for it. There's a relationship between the Barbie arrest in Mexico, one of the head assassins of the cartel in Cuernavaca, and the fact that Paris Hilton is taking her coke products here in Las Vegas and admitting guilt in snorting cocaine in Las Vegas. That's the market for those products, and as long as that relationship exists, you will continue to have narco-trafficking take place.
I was just about to bring up the Paris Hilton thing myself, where she got a little slap on the wrist. It's extraordinary that, well, of course, that's another story, the differences between what your class is and what your skin color is when it comes to arrest for cocaine here in the United States, what community you live in.
She got essentially a deferred sentence because of her status and her social class, and that's the reality, whereas someone in the community would be getting 10 years or more for a similar offense, and we've seen plenty of evidence of that in terms of what the district attorneys actually pursue in that relationship. But there's a concrete relationship between the violence that's wrecking Latin America and the fact that you have an illicit, unregulated market for drugs in the United States, the largest in the world.
Well, my guest is Miguel Tinker-Salas. We're talking about the situation in Mexico. Another ingredient, I suspect, has contributed to this was this is kind of, I see, as a byproduct of the decision by former President Salinas de Gortari to privatize the ejido system before he left office and actually open Mexico to international investment, whereas at least there was a fig leaf beforehand where a Mexican national had to own at least 51% of any Mexican business, and farmers, as long as they, campesinos, as long as they worked the land, it was their land. How much has that destruction of the ejido system and the privatization contributed to this?
Well, I think it's that not just simply the destruction of the ejido system, but what it did to the countryside. The Mexican government withdrew from the countryside, where in the past it had, at least, as you said, a fig leaf, had provided credits, had provided markets, had provided some structure for maintaining some semblance of growth in the countryside. It essentially withdrew from the countryside. And it also reformed Article 27 of the Constitution, which was a dramatic change in terms of how ownership of land was held for the countryside in Mexico. That meant you have thousands of people now unemployed. People have two choices, or three choices. They can actually migrate to the U.S., migrate to the cities, or increasingly join the ranks of the narco-traffickers. And it's from within these ranks, these individuals who have no hope, who lack total hope. In Mexico, they're being called ninis, N-I-N-I, not educated and no job. And in many ways, then, they really turn to the narco-traffickers who recruit them, who offer them payment, who offer them a job, who offer them a future, because in Mexico, for an entire generation of youth, there is no future. In fact, suicide rates in Mexico are a 10-year high. The third highest cause of death for young people between 14 and 21 are suicide rates. So we have a moment of desperation, a time of desperation in Mexico that lays the context for this economic crisis and for the reality faced by an entire generation of young people in Mexico who are facing a bleak future.
And well, Walmex Mexico sees them as a at least some of them as prospective customers to expand and change their lifestyle. It's a surreal situation.
It is surreal. You have in Mexico the appearance of modernity. You have in Mexico the veneer of progress. You can go to parts of Mexico City and think you are in either Paris or New York or Bel Air or Beverly Hills or any place else. Alongside of that coexists a reality of a country in which a significant number of people live in poverty, live with no hope, live with very little future. But that's a reality not just in Mexico. That's a reality throughout much of Latin America. And that's what's fueling the discontent, and that's what's fueling this crisis. But it's like as if you have people living in two separate worlds, facing two separate realities. And it's a very conflictive context then that provides the background as to why we have this ongoing drug war in Mexico when you have lucrative markets also in the U.S.
Well, it's also interesting that the U.S. Approach to Mexico has always been is a very strange one. It's a very paternalistic one. And most Americans are not aware of the dependency the United States economy has on Mexico, not in terms of oil, in terms of labor. We have cheap vegetables in our markets. They're inexpensive, thanks to underpaid labor. And yet we have this war going on here in terms of immigration, in which has been going on for years. It's like a political battle that seems to be destined to remain a political battle, so the status quo more or less remains. How much has the crackdown on so-called illegal immigration contributed to the situations now in Mexico?
Well, I think that the reality is that to the extent that you shut down the border, you create a pressure cooker within Mexico. This has been a historical reality within Mexico. The border has always been an outlet for social discontent. It has been that since the 1880s when American actual labor contractors went into Mexico to recruit laborers. It was a outlet in the 1910s during the Mexican Revolution when many people trying to avoid the conflict actually fled north. It was that during the 1930s and 40s when U.S. again contract labor went to Mexico to attract workers. It was that during 1942 when it was called the Bracero program, when during World War II Mexican workers filled the ranks of agricultural workers in the U.S. And it's been that through the 60s and 70s into the current period. So to the extent that the U.S. actually begins to shut down the border and actually increase pressure within Mexico, many of these social conflicts will actually become much more exacerbated. So that I suspect that we're looking at a situation within Mexico in which not only is the government relying increasingly on the military to deal with narco traffickers, but also, as it did in Colombia with Plan Colombia, the presence of the military and the militarization of society is also a major factor in assuring that there isn't a social explosion.
Now, you mentioned the 1910. November 20th is coming up, which is the anniversary of the uprising when Francisco Madero called upon his compatriots to take over the plazas in their cities and rise up against the Diaz government. How much there have always been operating at some level or another groups, guerrilla groups in Mexico, in various parts of Mexico, Guerrero particularly, but others places that do not connect it with drugs that want to have a new Mexican revolution. They've been largely dormant, at least as far as I can tell. What are the possibilities of them rising up or even making connections with the narco-traffickers as the U.S. is concerned about?
I don't see that as a real possibility in the current context. There is discontent in Mexico, but it's not being channeled through any current armed insurrection. We still have the ongoing conflict in Chiapas, in which the Zapatistas, the EZLN, are still organizing in indigenous communities and trying to create autonomous indigenous communities. So that project is still underway. There is a armed group called the ERP that operates in Guerrero and has staged several attacks on Pemex, Mexican oil installations, but really on a much smaller scale. The kind of discontent we see in Mexico is deep-seated. The kind of discontent is one that in many ways becomes a sort of a frustration with the Mexican system. It has lack of faith in all the institutions. All the parties have lost a tremendous amount of faith. But remember, the anniversary of the revolution is kind of an uncomfortable holiday for the PAN, who was always opposed to the Mexican Revolution, who always stood against it. They preferred celebrating the anniversary of independence. And we saw the spending of millions of dollars on September 15th in Mexico City for what essentially was a Walt Disney stage show that was supposed to make Mexicans feel happy. But the reality is that most Mexicans simply did not understand, could not comprehend what was worth celebrating, even at 200 year of anniversary of independence. So that for the PAN, the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, which as you mentioned is November 20th, is a rather uncomfortable holiday because their loyalties are not with that process.
Is there a potential for another Mexican Revolution?
I don't see it at this point. The opposition, the left, the so-called left political parties are completely dispersed. They are racked with internal divisions.
You're speaking of the PRD.
I'm talking about the PRD, yes. Which after the election in 2006, in which López Obrador claimed to have won the presidency, he was their candidate, the party fell into disarray. It fell into factional fighting. It was confronted with otra campaña, the other campaign on the part of the UZLN, who did not have faith in the established political structure. I think at this point there is a tremendous amount of discontent, but there isn't a concrete way to channel that discontent except into individual state or regional protest or rebellions, but there isn't anything of the kind they would talk about in terms of a national process that one would see similar to what happened in 1910.
But Mexico seems more and more like a failed state.
It is a failed state in many ways. It's a failed state not just around the question of narco-traffickers. It's a failed state because 50% of the population lives in poverty. It's a failed state because people have no hope. It's a failed state because it doesn't provide education. It's a failed state because it doesn't provide health care. That's why, it's more of a failed state than simply because it can't control the violence in its countryside. The violence is an expression of the fact that the state has essentially withdrawn from its own internal social project. It does not address social and political issues in a way that it should, that addresses the interests of most Mexicans, and I think that's why it's a failed state.
When is the next Mexican presidential election scheduled, and is that almost irrelevant at the moment?
It's for 2012, and there's already all kinds of jockeying. The PRI is, and according to all polls, is the leading party to regain the Mexican presidency. Here's the irony that in 2000, the PRI is ousted from office by a coalition of the right, and the voto útil, the useful vote on the part of the left who voted for Vicente Fox in order to defeat the PAN. And now the PRI is actually poised to retake the Mexican presidency. It controls the highest number of governorships, and its candidate, Mr. Peña, from the state of Mexico, is already posturing and testing the waters to run for a presidential bid in 2012.
My guest is Professor Miguel Tinker Salas. We are talking about the situation in Mexico. If you have any comments or questions, the number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. Mexico, of course, can't be separated, the problems of Mexico from the problems of Latin America entirely. You mentioned to me in an email the importance of elections coming up this Sunday in Venezuela, parliamentary elections, and I see that there has been a considerable international, or particularly coming from the United States, attempts to drum up criticism and fear of President Hugo Chavez and making connections to the Venezuelan government again with the FARC. Perhaps you could talk a bit about that.
There are elections for parliament in Venezuela on September 26th, and there are also elections for president in Brazil on October 3rd. These are very important elections in the context of the political panorama in Latin America. This will be the first time in which the opposition will actually run candidates for the parliament. We should recall that in 2005, they opted not to participate, granting Chavez a supermajority in the parliament and giving him the ability to pass legislation in many ways without any concrete opposition within the parliament. This time, they are participating. They have basically resurrected the question of violence and insecurity in the country as their number one issue. And internationally, we see that being reflected in articles in the LA Times and also in The Economist and others. And we see that also being reflected in recycling issues that the Venezuela is supporting instability in the region. But the reality is that the Venezuelan government and the Colombian government, after the election of Mr. Santos back in taking office in August, have in fact reestablished diplomatic relationships. They have put to one side those differences, and that issue has in many ways then been discredited because the Colombian government recognizes that there was no evidence to what Mr. Uribe was saying before he left office regarding so-called FARC camps within Venezuela. And although it's mentioned and repeated, no one actually has any hard evidence. In many ways, it's the same thing that happened with the computers, those indestructible computers that were recovered in Ecuadorian rainforest after a bombing on the part of the Colombian military. they're constantly used but never actually presented as evidence. So one always has to question as to what the origins of that information are. But the elections are going to be contested elections. It's more likely that Venezuela will have now a plural parliament. The real question becomes to what will be the majority, who will have the majority. All the polls are indicating that the Chavistas will maintain a majority, but they will not have the supermajority. So that does change the political context in Venezuela. And these elections now on September 26th are really a rehearsal also for presidential elections, which will take place in 2012. So both Mexico and Venezuela will be having presidential elections in the same year, and they will be very important in the context of both those countries. And then in the context of Brazil, you have presidential elections, which will really test the legacy of Mr. Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, the current president and the very popular president. The PT, the Party of Labor, has designated Dilma Rousseff as their candidate, and she's confronting a challenge from the Social Democrat José Serra for the presidency of Brazil, which will also be a determining election because Dilma Rousseff assures continuity with the project that Mr. Lula started, and Mr. Serra promotes the idea of closer ties to the U.S. And distancing himself and Brazil from the context of Latin America.
That was a good answer. Thank you for that. Here's your first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Well, you just touched on something that's related to my question. Do you see any attempt by the more progressive leftist groups in Mexico to reach out south toward the more progressive governments that are now coming apart, coming to the fore in South America and Central America? And if those ties get strengthened, do you feel that the United States would attempt to step on the whole thing because of Mexico's close contact with the U.S. being in its backyard and everything like that? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Actually, in the 2006 election, the issue, just about every election in Latin America, the opposition has to the left in the campaign has run an election premised on the fact that if the left candidate won, it would be a victory for Hugo Chavez. So that in Mexico in 2006, López Obrador was actually sort of sidelined, and the PAN's candidate, Calderón, ran ads that featured Chavez and López Obrador as if they were holding common cause. The same thing happened in elections in El Salvador, in which the opposition ran, essentially the Arena Party ran ads depicting Mr. Funes, the president, as a Chavista ally. So that Venezuela has been the central theme in elections in Peru, in Brazil, in El Salvador, and in Mexico. But to your answer, the reality is that there exists very little ties between the PRD as the official left party within Mexico and the process in Venezuela, and beyond simply some groups who have expressed solidarity with what's happening in Bolivia or Ecuador or Brazil or Venezuela. There hasn't been any real concrete ties between what's happening in Mexico. And that has to do an awful lot with the fact that Mexico operates in a different orbit. Since the 1980s, the Mexican political elite consciously separated Mexico from the rest of Latin America and isolated it because their project was so much oriented towards the U.S., towards the North. And we saw a distancing of Mexico, so much so that Mexico, who had a historic role in the context of Latin American foreign policy, found itself on the sideline of things like the Rio Group, on the sidelines of Latin American common integration, of UNASUR. And in many ways, Mexico purposely isolated itself, and that had a repercussion for social movements as well as political processes in Mexico.
That's interesting because you say the separation has begun long ago. When you're in school, you learn about Mexico and Central America, and the separation begins in our schools there. We have another call here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have reportedly Mexican cartels here in Mendocino County in Northern California growing marijuana. And I'm curious as to your take on why this continues to occur without it being eradicated. It seems that local law enforcement is paid by the federal government to train agents from the feds and the state agencies to know what to look for and also to assist on these raids. And in fact, we've had reportedly a couple of people from Mexican cartels killed by local law enforcement and the feds. So my question is, how likely is this to be eradicated, seeing that maybe the cartels don't pay off our local law enforcement people, but the feds do because those cartels are here? And how likely is it that we might see actual retaliatory violence of the kind in Mexico because of these type of activities and the shooting of these people. Thank you.
Well, I think that as we know, marijuana production in California is surpassing most agricultural traditional agricultural products. It's not only happening in California; it's been happening, in fact, for the last 20 years. It's been happening in Oregon, Washington, Hawaii. As many farmers in California and elsewhere found that the recession for prices for agricultural products dropped, they actually turned towards growing marijuana. The recent studies have demonstrated that that's been a case throughout. The introduction of the cartels to producing here. Is a logical extension of their economic model. That is, take the production in the market and do it in the same location. It's unfortunate, but that's part of that reality. And the drug war doesn't end at the border. And the drug cartels don't disappear when they see the U.S.-Mexican border. They have connections in the U.S. They operate with different forms of organized crime and different gangs in the U.S. In much the same way as they do throughout the region. So it's an issue not just in Mexico or in Central America or in Colombia. It's an issue here as well. And it has to do, in essence, with what I mentioned before, the fact that there is an unregulated market for illicit products in the U.S.
Thank you very much for that. It has been an increasing problem up here. Marijuana is probably the largest cash crop in Mendocino County. It competes with the wine industry, but the wine industry, of course, takes its profits elsewhere. But so usually when votes come up here concerning marijuana, even those people who don't partake in it realize that it is helpful to the Mendocino economy. One thing, while I have you on the phone, I'm interested in your thoughts about what's going on in the island of Cuba and the recent speech of Fidel Castro, which seems to be reflect an opening to at least a mixed capitalist socialist model, and what do you think about that?
Well, I think that what's happening in Cuba is fascinating. I mean, I think that everyone jumped on the Goldberg statement, that is the statement that appeared in the Atlantic blog concerning the economy not being something to export. But what Fidel was saying, and what it was others have been saying, is that statement was taken out of context. What he's talking about is that economic models can't be exported any more than social or political models. Every country has to develop their own structure, their own operation. Cuba has reached a point in which it has produced more educated individuals in the economy can actually absorb. That's why Cuban doctors travel to places like Mozambique and Angola and Venezuela and Nicaragua and elsewhere. And they're going to be forced, because of economic realities, to gradually lay off 500,000 state employees. And as such, they're going to be allowing for the private sector to try to open up and accept some of those individuals and to incorporate some of those individuals and to incorporate the private sector in that process. So I think it's, in many ways, a reflection of the realities they're facing. But I don't think that they're abandoning either their ideals, their political orientation. And it's interesting how quickly the U.S. media jumped on something like that without delving further into it. But it's also what Fidel was trying to get across was that he has a fear that the current crisis over Iran and efforts on the part of the U.S. and other countries to block any development of the nuclear power in Iran might lead to an escalated world conflict. And that's what he was trying to get across to Goldberg. And that's been hidden in much of the reporting because Goldberg had actually published an article about that. And that's what he was trying to get across in that discussion with Goldberg as well.
Yes, actually, Goldberg is one of the most important pro-Israel Jewish journalists in the country, a veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces, served as a prison guard in Israel, although he's an American citizen, didn't serve in the U.S. military. But it was a very important interview that he got because he seems to get to interview many of the world leaders.
But he had written an article about the potential for a conflict between Israel, Iran, and the U.S., and apparently Fidel had read it, and apparently it was based on that interview that he invited him.
Exactly, and Goldberg seems to have been, some have interpreted the article as being an endorsement for an Israeli or U.S. attack on Iran. Actually, yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham became the second senator after Joe Lieberman to call for the U.S. to attack Iran. So there's also the connections the U.S. consistently tries to make between Iran and Venezuela. And the two countries have established close relationships. So if you could talk about that.
Well, Iran is part of, as an oil-producing country, Venezuela is an oil-producing country, and Venezuela and Iran have a common interest in terms of developing an oil industry. They are members of OPEC. Venezuela is one of the founders of OPEC, along with Saudi Arabia, so that under the government of Chavez, you've had a resurgence of relation with Middle Eastern and Arab countries that have to do with common sense of interest that with the price of oil. In addition, there has been some shared technology in terms of building tractor factories and car factories, and that's been much of the extent of the exchange. Iran has also been in developing relations with Brazil, with Bolivia, with Ecuador, with other countries in the region, so that Venezuela is not alone in this process. Many of the other countries of the world have different kinds of sets of relationships with Iran and other countries of the region, and Venezuela sees an economic advantage and a trade advantage in those sets of relationships.
And, of course, both of them are targets of attack by the United States, which that would bring them together in a certain sense politically, being in a common situation, being targeted by U.S. propaganda continuously.
That's correct. In other words, they have been targeted, and they have seen some benefit in a common set of responses to those attacks.
Now we've come down to the just about the end of another interesting interview with you. Are there any final comments you'd like to make about the situation, either Mexico or Venezuela?
Well, I think that again, people in the U.S. need to follow what's developing in the region, be conscious of what's happening, be conscious of our participation in that process, not simply listen to the latest media feed from Washington or from the State Department, which increasingly sounds much about the same, and take a conscious role in what's happening. We bear, in the case of the drug war, the U.S. bears a direct responsibility for what's happening in Mexico. It's not simply a shared responsibility based upon the sale of weapons. It's a shared responsibility based upon the U.S. is the largest illicit, unregulated market for drugs in the world, and that's contributing to the violence in Mexico as well. But the solution cannot be, as it's not in Afghanistan and Iraq, the solution cannot simply be a military solution. There has to be a comprehensive social solution that involves the U.S., that involves a comprehensive immigration bill, and that involves social and economic policy and a change in U.S. policy towards Latin America.
Well, thank you very much, Miguel Diego-Salas, for being our guest for another interesting, informative interview about what's going on in Mexico, Venezuela, Latin America. We hope to have you back again in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.